Okay, I'm not exactly sure where we were, but somewhere in the midst of chapter 4, in previous verses, he has said, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge," a primary duty, actually, of the priests would be to teach the people God's will, and they had failed in that, and actually both people and priests, everyone is being charged in this chapter. Well, verse 9, "And it shall be like people, like priest. I will punish them for their ways and repay them for their deeds." As one reads all of these verses together in chapter 4, I almost get the sense that the people and the priests, in a sense, with their sins, feed upon one another. The priests, who should have been faithful in teaching the people, had not been, and at the same time, the people sinned on their own. The Lord will punish both. "They shall eat and not be satisfied. They shall play the whore, but not multiply, because they've forsaken the Lord to cherish whoredom, wine, new wine, which take away the understanding." A part of the worship of Baal and the worship at the golden calves in the northern kingdom was feasting, and so I think in a sense this is brought to light in verse 10. They'll eat but not be satisfied. In a broader sense, one practiced the religion of Baal in order to have good crops, in order for one's herds and flocks to multiply, just blessings all around. But in more than one situation, the Lord is saying to them, you will eat, but you won't be satisfied. You're trying to do the things that supposedly helps the god Baal bless you, but all of that will come to naught. Verse 12, "My people inquire of a piece of wood, and their walking staff gives them oracles. For a spirit of whoredom has led them astray, and they have left their God to play the whore." There's a whole lot that I don't know about Baal worship. I'm working on that, try to understand that better all the time. The golden calves at Bethel in the south and Dan in the north obviously are a part of the pagan worship that the people indulged in. I don't think those things are strictly a part of Baal worship, and I suspect this is not specifically there either, but the people are guilty of many different pagan practices, and so one is mentioned here. I won't go far on this little tangent, but I grew up knowing of people divining for water, finding water to know where to drill wells and so forth. I don't know what experience you've had of that, but this reminds me of that. There's a name for this, inquiring of a piece of wood, or actually, usually it's a wooden staff, but I can't remember the name. But the practice apparently was the priest would draw a circle and then section off the circle itself and give each division a message for the future, and then a staff or pole was held upright in the middle, but then allowed to drop to the ground, and whatever section it fell on then was the message for the future. Obviously, pagan in many different ways, but obviously this is another another one of the practices that they had fallen into. They sacrifice on the tops of the mountains, and this is certainly directed to Baal, the high places under groves of trees and so forth. They sacrifice on the tops of the mountains and burn offerings on the hills under oak, poplar, terebinth, because their shade is good. Therefore, their daughters play the whore, and your brides commit adultery. This suggests, I think, that this is an ongoing thing from one generation to the next. I will not punish your daughters when they play the whore, nor your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go aside with prostitutes and sacrifice with cult prostitutes, and a people without understanding shall come to ruin. No need to punish one group, particularly the daughters, the younger people, because all are guilty, and it wouldn't be just or fair to do that. This is the only place that I remember in the book that we have the cult prostitute named, and I don't believe in the book that Gomer is called a cult prostitute, but if I think about it in the context of the entire book, an unfaithful spouse, as Gomer obviously was, would be grouped with those who commit sins of the same kind in cult worship. So all of that is certainly together a part of the message. Though you play the whore, verse 15, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Judah is mentioned here, I forget now, may have a notation on another slide, maybe the second time that Judah is mentioned. Judah will be mentioned more as we go along. What I'm thinking of here is the message primarily is to the northern kingdom, Israel, but Judah is beginning to do some of the same sinning that the northern kingdom has done, and so Judah is mentioned and actually will be mentioned more frequently as we go along. The wording seems to say, don't cause Judah to sin like you have been sinning, but that would certainly be a message to Judah as well. Lower on the slide, I've suggested if we have a court case here and we're in court, Judah at this point is a little bit like a spectator in the audience, watching and listening to what is going on. So this is kind of an aside to Judah. Take a lesson from them. Don't commit the sins that they commit. Okay, two places are mentioned. Enter not into Gilgal, nor go up to Beth Aven, and swear not as the Lord lives. I think both of these places are close enough to the southern kingdom, Judah, that the message is don't be tempted by that which is nearby. Gilgal is near Jericho. Actually, this is the place where this new generation of children of Israel were circumcised after the wilderness wandering. The Passover was observed. So this would be a place that they would remember, all right. This would be the place where they camped at the time that they marched around the city of Jericho. And that's a pattern I think we see as we go forward. If Hosea mentions place names, towns, then those are usually places that have significance for the people, and that makes his message all the stronger. Don't meddle in Israel's affairs, obviously, is the message for Judah. Don't get caught up in them. Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone. Before I go on to the next verse, obviously the message to Judah is worship in Jerusalem as you are supposed to, and don't go up to the hill shrines in the northern kingdom. Okay, not only do not enter into Gilgal or go up to Beth Avon, but don't swear. Swear in the sense of the good kind of pledge, as the Lord lives, I will or will not. This is not the most important aspect, but it occurred to me in the story of Elijah and Elisha, and ultimately Elisha replacing Elijah when he is taken up. At the end, as the Lord moves them around from place to place and finally takes Elijah up in the whirlwind, this is the pledge that Elisha is making to him each time. As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. At the close, of course, Elijah is taken up by the Lord in a whirlwind, chapter 2 of 2 Kings. But the basic message, of course, is don't use such a pledge, such a vow, at one of those sites that is not Jerusalem. Okay, I think I've mentioned before that there are several images that Hosea uses, disparaging images in most cases of the people of Israel, but this is one here, like a stubborn heifer. Israel is stubborn. Can the Lord now feed them like a lamb in broad pasture? Okay, I'm not the most experienced person handling cattle and sheep and so forth, but I would understand for sure that if you have a stubborn animal, you certainly can't deal with them out in the open. You need a corral, you need a pen of some kind, and that's the image here. How can the Lord feed Israel on the loose out in a broad pasture? Okay, verse 17 is important because this is the first time where Israel, the northern kingdom, is called Ephraim. Okay, it's going to be the Ephraim as a name will be used many times later. After I made my notes here 31 times, I read somewhere, and I haven't had time to go back and check it. I did my own counting. I thought I was very careful. I counted 31 times. Well, that's not that important. It simply says that there are many times that Ephraim will be used now through the remainder of the book, and Ephraim stands for Israel. Some people suggest that the reason is that Ephraim is the largest tribe. I can't make that square because Ephraim didn't have the most land area. I went back and looked at some of the figures, the census that Joshua took, and Ephraim is not a large tribe at that time. What I do remember, and I can't remember specifics to share with you right now, is Ephraim is an assertive tribe. They complain a lot, and they were able to throw their weight around often and get their way. Well, in ways like that, they were prominent and powerful and somewhat in the center of things where their allotment of land was. And Jeroboam the first king of the northern kingdom, was from that tribe. And I don't remember now where all the capitals were, but I think they probably were all in the territory of the tribe of Ephraim. But the important point is that I understand from this point on that Ephraim is Israel. Okay, verses 18 and 19 that close out this fourth chapter repeat some of the things that we've seen before. When their drink is gone, and all of these references in some way or the other refer to what has gone on at the high place as they worshiped Baal or whoever it might have been. When their drink is gone, they give themselves to whoring. Their rulers dearly love shame. A wind has wrapped them in their wings. in the Old Testament, word for wind can also be spirit. Actually, that's true in the New Testament as well. So the same is true here. It could be spirit. In fact, I could think of that a spirit of whoredom has engulfed Israel, and I think an appropriate image is to picture a whirlwind. Israel has been engulfed because of her sins, has been engulfed in a whirlwind. In the first part of chapter 5, it seems to me that we have the evidence summarized, and so that means there's some repetition, but then he'll continue from there toward the promise of punishment coming for the people of Israel. He condemns the leaders for trapping innocent people, for exploiting the people. There's no justice in the land. They're sinking deep in sin. In fact, so deep that they can't have the power to repent and turn back to God. In other words, their sins are actually paralyzing them. What's the cause? They simply don't know the Lord. And this is mentioned in several verses. Their arrogance has led them to stumble and fall. All of us probably remember Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Even if at this point, Hosea says, even if they come with their entire flocks and herds and would sacrifice them all, God's not there to meet them. He's withdrawn himself from them. He rejected their illegitimate children. In verse 7, we'll see the phrase alien children, alien to God, of course, is the meaning. And their monthly feast would become funerals. The new moon shall devour them with their fields. I may repeat this later, but let me go back to that. I always need help with seeing the fine points in passages like this, but think about it in this way. The new moons quite often would be the time when I celebrate for that great crop that I was able to grow this year. But what he is saying here is that far from being able to celebrate about an abundant crop, actually just the opposite will be true. And then he uses another image, the new moon shall devour them in their fields. So what they normally would celebrate as a great, great crop actually is a failure. And so they are lost, devoured in that way. Okay, picking up with verse 1, hear this, O priests, pay attention, O house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king. Everyone is spoken to, the priest, the king, the people. You have been a snare at Mizpah and a net spread upon Tabor. These, again, are places of significance from their past, and the snare is a net type instrument by which birds could be caught, trapped, and it's a good image to express the situation they're in here. I think what is being said in this section is that whether it's the king or whether it's priests, they have entrapped the people. They have misused the people. Again, two places. Mizpah is in Gilead on the east of the Jordan. Tabor is a mountain in the valley of Jezreel. And again, they were important places in Israel's past. Mizpah, for instance, was the home of Jephthah. So if I go back to the book of Judges, he is one of the judges in that he is a deliverer at a particular time of his people. That's an interesting story. Jephthah was an illegitimate son, so his brothers ran him into exile. But when the Ammonites threatened and they couldn't think of any other way out, they sent for him and asked him for their help. Of course, he had an attitude, and he says, well, okay, I'll do it, and if I accomplish what you want, then I am your leader. You answer to me and everything. And indeed, he was successful, so he's one of the judges that we read about in the book of Judges. Tabor was a place where Barak destroyed the army of Sisera. Interesting story too. Barak never would have done it had it not been for the urging of the prophetess Deborah. In fact, it's more than urging, as I remember Deborah makes a case that he cannot avoid. And so he does take up the task and is successful with God's help. So again, both of those places, they could associate with victory. A good time in the history of the people. And they are probably mentioned because they have become special places for pagan worship as well. Verse 2 of chapter 5 is difficult. We don't have much to go on. Many suggest that going deep into slaughter is actually a reference to child sacrifice. If that seems a little far-fetched, in a moment, a few slides down, King Ahaz is mentioned in that regard. But if I want an example of that, Psalm 106, beginning at verse 36, actually does refer to child sacrifice almost too great to fathom, but it happened in that day. Verse 3, I know Ephraim and Israel is not hidden from me. Ephraim and Israel, one and the same, two different ways of saying it. For now, O Ephraim, you have played the whore. Israel is defiled. I think there's a play on words here, in sense maybe a subtle barb in that, God saying, I know you, but you don't know me. But more than that, you think you are doing the things you do without my knowing, but I know you, and I know what you have done, but you don't know me at all. Verse 4, the Lord knows Israel, though Israel does not know the Lord. Okay, I think that's important for us to stop and talk about. Maybe I can describe it to you this way. This is probably the most important word. There's more than one word for know in Hebrew, and I find those others in the Old Testament as well. But this is the one that I find most often. I don't know whether you can picture this or not, but I opened up one of the big I've lost my word now. the tool by which I see the listing of words and concordance. Opened up a big concordance, and this word in the Old Testament in fine print, I believe it was three full pages just for this word alone. This word is a big word, an important word. So when I use the word and I say I know God, I may simply mean I know about God. But this word actually describes the intimacy of husband and wife, the greatest intimacy. And it's important that I understand that this is how God speaks with that word. Israel may not understand it, but that's what's being said. For instance, I know one place that this word is used is Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived. So I think that's an important word to make. Yes, the people, even in their sin, knew things about God, but God says that's not what I'm talking about. You don't know me. I know you thoroughly. I know the things you have hidden. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Israel and Ephraim, the two names together, shall stumble in his guilt. Judah shall also stumble with them. Okay, this isn't stubbing your toe. This is something that could result in death. It could be fatal, a serious word for sure. In this context, I get the idea that Israel has a place in leading the southern kingdom, Judah, astray as well. So the last part of verse 5, Judah shall also stumble with them. In terms of the ultimate punishment of being carried away into captivity, both Israel and Judah will suffer that, but Judah a little over 100 years later. So it does come later. And I think I'm correct in understanding that Judah at this point hasn't gone as far as Israel. With their herds and flocks, they shall go seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He is withdrawn from them. Okay. Though they went to Mizpah and Tabor and other places, or if they did, the Lord wouldn't necessarily be there. He was not pleased anymore with their commitments. They have dealt faithlessly with the Lord, for they have borne alien children. Now the new moon shall devour them in their fields. I've already talked about, gotten ahead of myself, I guess. The new moon normally would be celebration for great crop, but it's just the opposite. Their festivals will actually devour them and their fields and their crops. Well, then in the next half of chapter 5, the sentence is pronounced. Charges have been made and summarized, and now sentence is pronounced. In a word, the sentence is, or the verdict is guilty. A day of judgment is coming when the cities of Israel will be conquered by the invading Assyrian armies, citizens taken away into captivity, at first basically the whole land taken, the whole population taken away. So verse 9 says, it shall become a desolation in the day of judgment. There is a sense in which Hosea pictures God at work in a gradual way in punishing Israel, a moth and dry rot. And in the same section, the image of a lion. The Assyrians indeed would attack like a lion would attack, tear and go away, or carry off and no one be able to find it. And God in the end will say, but I am more of a terror to you than Assyria. Verse 8, blow the horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, sound the alarm at Beth Avon. We follow you, O Benjamin. That's a difficult, not just for me, but a difficult verse for commentators to deal with, particularly the O Benjamin. Well, the message, of course, first is that the enemy is here, almost upon you, so the alarm has to be sounded. Blow the horn, that's the ram's horn, that's mentioned more than any other instrument of that kind in the Bible. The trumpet would be beaten out of silver, but both of those would be used to warn the people of danger, or in the good sense, to call them together for a religious event. Gibeah and Ramah are located more or less on the border with Israel in Judah. I think Isaiah gives us a little bit of understanding with this. In Isaiah 10, he pictures the approach of the Assyrian army from one village to another toward Jerusalem. Okay, I can't work out the specific time and understand which direction the enemy armies are approaching. But I think what is being said here, three places are in the line of approach of an invading army. So Gibeah and Ramah, actually, if we could put them on a map, and it's hard to find a map where I have the two cities that I want at a particular time. But if we were able to see them on a map, I think they're kind of in line, north and south, and then Beth Avon further north, but in line as well. You're in the path of destruction. Okay, the mention of Benjamin is one of the most difficult things I think we have encountered as far as knowing exactly what is said. Literally, what's said is, "After you, Benjamin," maybe meaning they're coming after you, Benjamin. There are other places in line ahead of you, but they are on the way. Okay, one commentary says Benjamin here is another name for Judah. Well, Benjamin is overlooked many times. Back in Judges, the tribe of Benjamin almost lost its identity, In the rise of two nations, the northern kingdom Israel, southern kingdom Judah, Benjamin is almost left out. So it is true that Benjamin would still be connected with Judah, but I'm not sure that's what is mentioned here. What some would say, and I am inclined to go that direction, is that these places mentioned here in this context actually would be in what was the tribe of Benjamin territory before. Ephraim shall become a desolation in the day of punishment. Among the tribes of Israel I make known what is sure. Israel, the northern kingdom, will be laid waste by the Assyrians. I think that is the reference to that to happen in a later time. And Hosea says, "I have that from the Lord." The Lord, I, says, "I make that known for sure. You can count on this for sure." The princes of Judah have become like those who move the landmark. Upon them I will pour my wrath like water. I think it was just last week that I saw footage on the news of the water rushing down the mountain in California after the fires, mud and water running down the mountain at great speed right across the Pacific Coast Highway and dumping into the ocean itself. Well, those who understand the Hebrew word say that it pictures overflowing fury. So what I saw on TV, I think, would match what's being said here. We're about out of town at time, but I'll just mention this. One of their sins is they moved the boundary stones. Tribes had boundary stones when they were given, when the land was divided up among them. And my neighbor had boundary stones, and I had boundary stones as well. I grew up on a place. My parents lived elsewhere, later, my dad passed on. My older brother had the responsibility of dealing with the property. What he found was that the neighbor over the years had moved his fence over on us about 10 feet. That's a modern way of moving the boundary stone. Well, too much time, too much expense, legal expense to do much about it, so he simply let it go. I would have done the same thing. But our neighbor was in the practice over time, at least, of kind of moving that fence a little more each time a new fence was built. Well, that might not be such a big thing for us, but it's taken very seriously in the Old Testament law. It's a sin against God, it's called a rebellious deed. Very serious, but it's interesting to me that of all the sins they commit, what we might call the religious sins, Hosea also mentions, by the way, you have moved the boundary stones. Well, we'll pick up here next time. Thank you for your attention.